Wisconsin Conversation, real information. Live from Lake Wissota, this is Up North News with Pat Kreitlow.
Well, here we go. Start of another week. By the way, this is going to be a four-day work week for us at the Radio Ranch. We will be taking Friday of this week off, and then the following Monday, taking a bit of a four-day weekend here. Of course, we'll still be pre-taping some interviews for use later in the week here. So it's still going to be a busy one for us, and we appreciate you sticking around. State Senator Kel DeRoyes joins us in our next segment here, right after we get this hour kicked off, by getting you reset on things in case you missed the Packers holding on to beat Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Bucks. What did that final turn out to be? 14-12, right?
Correct. 14-12. They needed that 2-point conversion. And Devondre Campbell is on my fantasy football team. So him swatting away that pass block was pretty great to see. I was a fan.
What is the Luke Mathers coached fantasy football team called this year? Oh no! Is it something you can't say on the radio?
No, I can't say it on the radio. My team name. I have four different leagues, so I kind of have a problem. I have one that is the Deep State Strikes Back. Nice. Playing off of the Empire Strikes Back. And a few years ago, when Trump first used the reference, my team name was the Deep State Cabal. And then the other team names I have are pretty much all nuclear espionage. So,
all right.
I like to poke
fun. You like to keep current events in there. I mean, other people in your league, they learn the news by just following your team name.
Well, and previously I had had, when Trump had said for the hurricane, I forget which hurricane it was back in 17 or 18, when he was like, well, why can't we just like drop a nuke in it to disrupt the hurricane? One year my team name was Nuclear Hurricane. So
Had he been able to get away with that, and again, I talked more seriously in the last hour about how Hurricane Ian is currently running right past Cayman Islands. I could see him dropping it there, or as it comes over western Cuba, to kind of use that as an excuse. And I mean, the places where things could have gone is just, I don't even want to think about that. We joke about it now.
I would say my team name is all just childish poking fun at the crazy things that Donald Trump has said.
Because if you don't laugh now and then, I mean, the work does go on. And so we have breaking news on this Monday morning where we have just learned that the January 6th Select Congressional Committee subpoenaed Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss over the weekend for testimony about a July phone call with former President Trump. The panel is demanding his testimony by today. Voss is suing to block the effort. He filed federal suit over the weekend, claiming the subpoena is outside the scope of the Select Committee's mission and imposes an undue burden by requiring him to comply so quickly. Voss's conversations with Trump pertain to a recently decided Wisconsin Supreme Court decision. In fact, I've got an excerpt from the letter here. To Voss, or from the subpoena, rather. The Select Committee's investigation has revealed that you have information relevant to its inquiry. Specifically, it has been publicly reported that in July 2022, you received a telephone call from former President Trump, in which he asked you to take measures to change the result of the 2020 election in Wisconsin. The call was apparently in response to a ruling of the Wisconsin Supreme Court in early July, barring the use of drop-off boxes outside election offices for absentee ballots in future elections. After you reportedly told Mr. Trump that what he was requesting is not allowed under the Wisconsin Constitution, Mr. Trump posted derogatory statements about you on Truth Social and endorsed your challenger in the 2022 Republican primary. The circumstances and details regarding your interactions with former President Trump related to the 2020 election are relevant to the Select Committee's investigation and proposed recommendation. Voss has attached to his lawsuit a letter from Benny Thompson, the congressman from Mississippi who chairs the January 6th committee, some of which that I read right there. And Trump wants the injunction to prohibit the panel from enforcing its subpoena, saying the only explanation for such an extreme timeline is the committee's desire to conduct the deposition before its next publicly televised hearing on September 28th, which would be this Wednesday. All I can tell you is it is refreshing. It is downright refreshing to see a committee try to move the process along rather than at this glacial pace. I have never understood why is it still in court whether we see Trump's taxes. That goes back years and years. Why is this taking years? Why are so many of these other cases? Look, I get due process, but I also get there will be no due process if there's no court system rooted in democracy, if there's no democracy. You've heard me talk about the belated sense of urgency for the Milwaukee Brewers. We are way overdue with a sense of urgency about the real threats to this country if we don't have some accountability for what happened on January 6th, 2021. And if that means Robin Voss has to be inconvenienced for the next couple of days, bring it on. State Senator Kelder Royce joins us after this break. You're up north. Wait for Senator Kelder Royce to join us. We'll cover a couple of other headlines around the state and the country. One that caught my eye, unfortunately, notes that Foremost Farms is shutting down its operations in two central Wisconsin communities, one in Plover, one in Milan. Foremost Foods says they will discontinue operations at those plants at the end of the year. This is according to News 9 WAOW. In all, more than 100 employees will be impacted by the decision. The company said via email, this decision is not a reflection on the performance of the employees. Not a reflection on the performance of the employees and leaders in these locations. We recognize their dedication to the cooperative and their communities. However, the board of directors and leadership have decided it's in the best interest of the performance of the cooperative as a whole to discontinue operations. All right, fine. That's typical bureaucratic, you know, whatever. But then they go on to say that they made the decision because of aging facilities and labor challenges, which have created financial inefficiencies. It would take significant investments to bring the plant up to date and add the kind of technology necessary, they said. So by their own admission, they intentionally set up these plants to be obsolete by refusing over the years to invest in upkeep or modernization. They set those plants up to fail. A tipping point arrives, and then the company just moves on. And, you know, that's just one of countless barriers toward keeping and maintaining good jobs all across Wisconsin, rural Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, everywhere, not to mention the continuing outflux of talent, a lot of it young, but just overall. And a report came out last week that really tried to quantify just how bad things have been over the years in terms of outflow. And the by the way, these things are not inevitable. Yes, the baby boomers are aging. We've talked about that. But, you know, between immigration reform and a more family-friendly environment, there's things the Wisconsin legislature could be doing if they weren't on a 10-month paid vacation. But, I mean, things they could have been doing over the years. And one of the people reacting to the report that certainly caught my attention is one of the real leaders in the legislature, Senator Kelder Royce, who joins us from the Madison area. Senator, good to talk to you.
Good to talk with you. Thanks for having me.
It's not rocket science what the legislature could be doing. But as we get to it, could I start first by asking about your reaction to having things quantified as to, you know, what our workforce challenges are?
Well, I think it's puts into really stark understanding what many of us have known for a long time, which is that Wisconsin's brain drain is a huge problem for our economy long term. It's a huge missed opportunity because we are raising people in Wisconsin, educating them, investing in them, and then the best and the brightest too often are seeking greener pastures. They want to leave the state, and many of them, when they leave, are not going to return. So that's a huge problem for our economy, and I think it's also hard for families, right? You know, grandparents want to see their grandkids raised nearby, and it's hard when a member of your family leaves and they live thousands of miles away and they don't come back.
It is, and it's again the environment that you could set up in the state, and you know, we don't. I'm just going to come back to the words, you know, brain drain here for a second, because you know, some people would get all worked up, like, oh, so you're saying that, you know, people without brains are the ones that stay behind? It's like, no, that's not the point here. The point though is we have been trashing education and higher education in this state, you know, since 2011. And when, I mean, to the point where there's a, you know, a war on teachers and public schools to this day, right in the campaigns that are happening right now. So it's not the world's biggest surprise that we're not seeing, you know, some of our best and brightest stay in Wisconsin and looking for opportunity elsewhere.
That's right. And I think, you know, what's important to understand is that these are policy choices. We could be making a different choice. It's not inevitable that people need to go to Chicago or New York or Atlanta or Denver or elsewhere to have great career opportunities, to live a good life. We could make it much more welcoming and enticing for people to stay here in Wisconsin. I think that's the goal.
And it's, again, it's not anything that hasn't been discussed before, but you know, your reaction to it said so much we could do to make Wisconsin a place where people would want to move to. Start with paid family leave, universal child care, great public transit, including high-speed rail, and a public bank that lets you refinance student debt. And we just talked about student debt in the last hour with Scott Ross. Again, stating the obvious, but you were one of the few people that, you know, was that explicit with a list that says, look, do these and we make things a little bit better.
Right. And, you know, and that's just whatever, 280 characters sort of thrown together on Twitter. There are so many things that I think Wisconsin has going for it. We have incredible natural resources, but if we don't protect those resources, if they're not available and accessible to people, what good is it? If we're going to sell off public lands and pollute our waterways, then it's not going to be the big draw that it could be. If we have great schools, but we're making things so miserable for teachers that they're leaving in droves and they're going elsewhere, then eventually we're not going to have the kind of public school systems that employers want and employees want to have their families in. So, you know, there's a kind of generational investment that need to be made that, you know, were made in the past here in Wisconsin, and we're kind of coasting a little bit on those past investments. But there's real opportunities to help make Wisconsin a very competitive place, especially for young families who are looking for, you know, something that's more affordable and maybe would want to come back and be closer to family or want to move here from elsewhere for a better quality of life. But we have to be a modern place that is welcoming to families and not, you know, not this kind of backwards looking, you know, bound by 1849 and, you know, racial animus and misogyny and homophobia that is a huge turnoff to young people.
Oh yeah. We're going to get more into the educational matters with State Superintendent Jill Underley in our next hour. But I can't help but ask you, we already know what gubernatorial candidate Tim Michaels has said, and you know, what his, you know, fix would be for education. It was echoed over the weekend by U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, who spoke on Friday in Milwaukee, where, again, he's trying to make the focus on crime. And he says his solution is renewed faith, stronger families, more supportive communities, And the blunt public policy prescription for me is universal school choice, which we all know would allow parents to receive taxpayer-paid vouchers to attend church-based and other private schools without any income limits. So, Senator, when you hear Jim Michaels and Ron Johnson say that universal school choice is some kind of an answer, does it sound like an answer to you to these challenges?
It's only an answer for a Republican Party that benefits from having people divided and from having people poorly educated. Unfortunately, so many of these voucher schools are totally unaccountable. And there, you know, there are certainly some good private schools out there, but many of these schools do not hire the same caliber of teacher. They don't have the same kind of accountability measures in place, and they certainly don't have to take all comers as the public schools do. You know, public schools are the engine of our democracy. We cannot be an effective self-governing community and nation if we don't all start in public schools and have the same basis of knowledge and understanding. So it's really offensive to me as a product of public schools and as a parent of kids in public schools that we should somehow send all of our public resources to private unaccountable schools that are really not going to be contributing to the success of our community in the same way that public schools do.
Senator Kelderoys is our guest this hour and talking a bit about workforce challenges and the, you know, the positions by the various candidates that may or may not help with that effort. So to put it in big picture stakes from a campaign standpoint, if Tim Michaels is elected governor and if you're still serving in the minority in the legislature, what is it that hasn't happened because of Governor Evers' veto pen that will happen starting next January that may only exacerbate the workforce challenges in Wisconsin?
Well, one of the things that I'm gravely concerned about is, of course, civil rights and gender equality. And right now, we have currently on the books this 1849 ban on all, virtually all abortions, and it's chilling medical care for people all over the state. And I'm concerned that we're going to see organized attacks on contraception, on LGBTQ rights. And those are the kind of things that, of course, have a horrible effect on especially people who are already marginalized. Wisconsin has one of the worst infant mortality rates in the nation and the worst for Black women. So these kind of really harsh laws only make Wisconsin a worse place to live and make us just seem so totally backwards in the eyes of, you know, especially the young people and, you know, the cutting edge employers that we really want to attract and retain here.
Well, and in trying to, you know, retain quality, attract and retain quality workers, beyond just schools and taking care of our resources, you mentioned again a couple of the things that have public in their name, which Republicans seem to oppose all of them: public schools, public transit, public parks, public libraries, you know, what have you. But in the couple of minutes I've got before break here, let's seize on the public transit one, either statewide by high-speed rail or just getting Milwaukee and its suburbs on the same page with you know, focusing on public transit. Is this another area that will suffer if you know, we don't have you know, Governor Evers' veto pen there with a Republican budget being passed next year?
Yes, and this is something that again is going to have a generational consequence. We made a huge generational error when Scott Walker gave away our $1 billion train money that would have connected Chicago and the Twin Cities through Milwaukee and Madison. And we're still recovering from that. Just imagine what it would do for the whole southern region of the state if we had that rail connectivity and how that would unleash economic connection and innovation and all the activity that would happen because of our increased mobility. I think it would make all the places along that rail corridor much more attractive for people to live in because it's just easier to get to big cities where there are opportunities. So those are the kind of investments that we're not going to see. If there is a Republican governor and a Republican legislature, they don't even want to let communities band together to plan jointly for things like rail and transit and transportation. And to me, that's just crazy. Of course, we want government entities coordinating with each other to make smart decisions and efficiently use their resources. The Republicans want things to be as inefficient as possible because they want to block any government entity from doing something that might be a big picture project.
Senator Kelda Royce is with us. We'll take this break and continue the conversation next. You're up north.
Follow Up North News with our daily newsletter. Go to our website, upnorthnewswi.com, and click newsletter on the top banner. Once again, here's Pat Kreitlow.
Back again with Senator Kelda Royce joining us to talk about, we started by talking about the Forward Analytics report that outlines the challenges to recruiting and retaining good Wisconsin workers and the various things that can be done to create a less hostile environment for young families. Certainly the biggest one this year deals with the repeal of abortion rights under Roe v. Wade and what kind of message that sends, that Wisconsin reverts to an 1849 ban and that we have a candidate for governor in Tim Michaels who says that that ban mirrors his values. And frankly, he's been supported by groups that would make things even more extreme for young women who would otherwise maybe like to live here, raise a family, have them really have second thoughts about that. So, Senator, I had said, early on that, Tim Michaels had an extreme position. At some point, he would probably try to move toward the middle. He didn't for the longest time. And then late last week, we hear him say, well, he would sign a bill with exceptions for rape and incest. That hardly sounds to me like somebody who's moderated his positions. And I think the bigger question here isn't that would he reluctantly sign, a bill, but how extreme a bill is this guy willing to sign if he gets the chance next year?
Well, I think it's, you just have to look where his money has gone. This is a person who has given thousands of dollars to the most extreme anti-choice organizations, one of which is an advocacy group that opposes all forms of contraception. They don't think people should have birth control or IUDs or the pill. He's also given money to a group that literally uses your phone to digitally track women when they go near a Planned Parenthood so that then they can barrage them with anti-choice misinformation and ads. I mean, digitally spying and tracking women. To me, this is not a person who is going to be capable of moderating his views. He believes that the 1849 law, which has no exceptions for a person's health, for rape, or for incest, he thinks that that's an exact mirror of his position. And I think, I understand why he wants to run away from that position, and Republican strategists are tearing their hair out because they know that he's just so far to the right. But frankly, supporting codifying Roe v. Wade is a mainstream position. Abortion rights and abortion access is not controversial. Americans do not want politicians in our doctor's offices. And now we're seeing, unfortunately, the terrible cost of efforts to criminalize pregnancy and make abortion unavailable. And it's devastating. Even people who never thought they would be in a position of needing abortion are not getting the care that they need and deserve to have because of the climate of fear that these abortion bans have and how it impacts the care that physicians are willing to give.
Another thing that would certainly make life more attractive for a lot of young families are those that have to process a mountain of student loan debt. And while President Biden's move does help in great ways for some people and in moderate ways for others, your idea of allowing refinancing of what remains is something, again, that would be useful for recruiting and retaining those younger families, I've got to believe.
Yeah, I think there's a real disconnect. When people who maybe went to school without debt or went to college when you could still work a summer job and make enough to pay your way through don't really understand how student loan debt works. It is not a mortgage that you can just go and refinance whenever the interest rates are low. Many people get locked into huge interest rates. And so even if they're not able to make the minimum payments, they can say they took out $50,000 in loans, they could pay back $75,000 and still be $50,000 in debt because the way that some loan programs restrict your ability to refinance. So what the Biden administration has done, I think, in addition to forgiving debt and especially taking on some of these for-profit predatory colleges, is really transformational because it's going to allow people to say, if you make the minimum payment that you're able to based on your income and you make your payments regularly for 10 years, we will forgive a good chunk of the balance when you're done. And we will make sure that your loan balance never goes higher than what it originally is. So if you borrow $20,000, you're never going to owe more than $20,000 as long as you're making that minimum payment. And that is a huge change. And that's something where, you know, the state of Wisconsin could enhance that by basically just treating student loan debt the same way that we would treat mortgages and letting people take advantage of low interest rates and financial markets so that they don't have as big of a burden.
Senator Kelda Royce is our guest for this hour. The senator is an attorney as well. So she has just a little bit more background than me when it comes to handling this next issue, which is our breaking news about how Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has been subpoenaed by the January 6th committee about a phone call that former President Trump made to him this past July, shortly after the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that drop boxes, which they previously had no problem with, are now illegal in the state of Wisconsin. And we know Trump has tried to put pressure on Voss ever since, you know, the November 2020 election. But I would imagine, Senator, that you're not really looking at Assembly Speaker Voss as a victim in all of this, of Donald Trump's bullying or what have you.
You know, Voss created this monster in many ways. Having the most extreme gerrymandering created a situation where many of his own caucus members are so extreme that they have nobody to be accountable to except the most off the deep end portions of their base. And so reasonable Republicans who have an ideology, you know, pre-Trump, really have no home in the Republican Party anymore, and they really are losing power. And it's a very scary thing for our democracy. There is a part of me that does, you know, feel a little bit sorry for Robin Voss because he's in this very dangerous situation that is of his own making. You know, the Republican Party went hook, line, and sinker along with Trump. They've coddled all of, you know, these authoritarian candidates that are really doing their best to undermine democracy and undermine the rule of law. And they're paying the price, but unfortunately, all of us are paying the price as we see how fragile our democracy is.
Voss did talk about the call back in July. Matt Smith from WISN-TV talked to Voss back in July, and Luke has just found the audio of that. So let's listen to Voss talking about that call.
When's the last time you talked to the former president, President Trump?
Within the last week.
Within the last week?
Yeah.
Before or after he tweeted about you?
Before.
And what was that conversation like?
It's one of those that it's very consistent. He makes his case, which I respect. He would like us to do something different in Wisconsin. I explained that it's not allowed under the Constitution. He has a different opinion, and he put the tweet out. So that's it. Yeah.
That one sound again makes him sound somewhat of a sympathetic figure. And I will admit, we're just in the area of speculation here. I don't know what it is about that phone call that the January 6th committee would find interesting. I can only, again, speculate. They must have learned something somewhere where they thought if they could hear directly from the source in that phone call, you know, it might corroborate something that they've heard. Again, Kelda, you went to law school. I'm sure you're cringing at this kind of amateur legal analysis right now, and I apologize for that.
Well, I mean, what really makes me cringe is that we have a speaker of the state assembly in Wisconsin that won't just stand up to this lawless bully, Donald Trump, who is trying to destroy our democracy, and just say flat out, sir, you did not win the election. What you are doing is bad for this country. It is unacceptable, and you need to get your act together and stop lying. You are destroying our democracy. And that's what a real leader would do.
another person in the Senate now, but is retiring, who again is one of the few Republican voices out there willing to stand up to Trump, is Kathy Bernier, who occupies the 23rd District Senate seat that I'd held about 15 years ago or so. And as I've said before, she and I disagree on a million things, but I mean, I found it almost refreshing, you know, to see her take that stance. Not a big surprise, being a former Chippewa County clerk, but I wonder if it strikes you as the same way it strikes me. It's kind of a mixed bag of, well, it's nice that you stand up to him now, but you know, you could have been more part of the solution earlier on.
Yeah, I mean, I think Trump is the culmination of so many of the seeds that have been sown for a long, long time in Republican Party politics. I mean, certainly the racism and the xenophobia, the really deep misogyny, and the embrace of conspiracy theories, right? So this didn't start with Trump. And that's part of the problem is, you know, you have Republican office holders who didn't stand up to that and didn't speak out. And so they are in some way complicit. That said, given I think that we're in such a perilous moment for democracy, we do have to give credit where it is due and say, you know, I'm going to set aside all of our many, many, many policy differences and say, you know, you did the right thing. And, you know, Liz Cheney is going to go down in history books as a hero who tried at great personal and political cost to save democracy. And she did do the right thing along with other handful of Republican colleagues. And if we want the Republican Party to return to sanity and to try to have to save our democracy, we have got to embrace when Republicans do the right thing and encourage it more.
The 23rd district is you know, one of those seats that likely is not going to flip this time around, especially with only a write-in candidate on the ballot. But let's talk about some of the districts where there are competitive races, some where Democrats are trying to hold and some where there are seats that are very much in play. So as you have been out and about this summer and early fall, helping out some of these candidates in some of these districts, what are a couple that come to mind as ones that you really have emphasized in the campaign and will be really watching with fingers crossed on Election Day?
Well, yeah, I have been all around the state knocking on doors and talking to Wisconsinites and voters about the issues that are important. And one of my favorite places in Wisconsin is northern Wisconsin along Lake Superior and the communities up north. And so there, that's a seat currently held by a Democrat, Janet Bewley. And there's a great Democratic candidate, Kelly Westland, who's running in that race. And she works for Tammy Baldwin. She's been on the Ashland City Council. And she's actually a great example of a transplant in. She grew up a military brat, came here to go to college and decided to stay. And it's like, yes, more of this, more Kelly Westlands. So we have another great candidate in the Appleton area, Chris Alfheim. That's an open seat. So that's a really interesting area of the state. It's definitely a purple part of the state. They've had Democratic representatives in the legislature. And so that's a seat where the Republican candidate is quite extreme and has a record that I think is pretty scary to most mainstream Republicans. And the Democratic candidate is really reasonable, moderate. She's a small business owner, really independent thinker on the Appleton City Council. So that's an interesting race. And then, of course, suburban Milwaukee. You know, these seats in suburban Milwaukee are changing. And when you think about how Dobbs changed the political landscape, that's an area of the state that's really, really energized because they don't want us to go back to 1849. So I think we'll see a big turnout for Democratic candidates and candidates who support women's right to choose in those areas.
And so finally, as we look to the, you know, the marquee races here, let's, you know, start with Senate really quick. For people who, again, don't follow things closely and they maybe were not familiar with Mandela Barnes, they're the, you know, the swing voters that we see now and then who have an open mind but just don't know enough. What is it that you want those voters to know about Barnes and Johnson and you know, how that choice should come down in your eyes?
Well, Mandela Barnes is just like such a typical kind Midwestern Wisconsinite. You know, he comes from a working class background. His mom is a teacher. His dad was a factory worker. And, you know, it was their union jobs that allowed him to grow up, go to college, get out of one of the poorest zip codes in Milwaukee and become lieutenant governor. So I think he's just got a really inspiring, wonderful story. And he actually understands the struggles that Wisconsinites face because he has lived them too. Contrast that with Ron Johnson, a guy who, you know, basically married into a billionaire family, a plastics fortune, and then is so out of touch that he says things like, and I'm not even talking about all the crazy COVID stuff and the conspiracies about, you know, sunspots causing climate change. But, you know, he says, like, we have enough jobs here. We don't need any jobs here. Yes. About his own backyard community. The idea that we would send good paying jobs away. Outrageous.
He is such a character. Senator Kelda Rice, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you.
As we've been talking about the campaigns and the messages that are put out in political commercials and, you know, in speeches and other rhetoric, we can't forget the language used by journalists in covering these races. I've mentioned previously that Soledad O'Brien, who you might remember most from her time with NBC News, but has worked, you know, as a very experienced reporter in several situations, is one of the leading voices reminding legacy journalists to do better, to not fall into language traps, and to not buy into biases that maybe they, the reporters, don't have, but manage to let, you know, right-wing language sound like they do. And what I mean by that, her most recent example is where she's calling out the Associated Press for an article over the weekend about language, about the words that journalists are using. And Soledad O'Brien wrote, "I often say that political journalists are failing you. And here is a good example from the Associated Press. We should weigh in on how this is both inaccurate and poorly framed." And here's the Associated Press tease to an article that she's referencing. Freedom, the word freedom. Freedom is increasingly invoked when President Biden, Vice President Harris, and other White House officials talk about abortion, as Democrats co-opt traditionally conservative language in an election year appeal to a broad range of voters. If you weren't listening carefully, you might not have caught her emphasis there, that what she's calling out is that the Associated Press is saying that Democrats are co-opting conservative language when they use the word freedom. In this case, talk about the freedom of a woman to determine what to do with her body and not let government talk about it, as if conservatives have possession of the word freedom, and as if it's not a word that can be co-opted. It's a word that should not be abused. If anything, it's not that Democrats are co-opting the word freedom from Republicans. It's that Republicans have used the word in such perverse and irrelevant ways over the years. Perhaps the most glaring example is freedom fries. Or these are freedom fries because we don't like France telling us, you know, what to do about the Iraq war. Again, there's so much in legacy journalism of treating politics as a sport, as something to do the play-by-play on. Dan Frumkin is another media critic, formerly of the Washington Post, who points out that in the case of this Associated Press language, rather than addressing whether or not a woman's freedom is at stake, which it is, they instead, the Associated Press, cast freedom as traditionally conservative rhetoric. And, you know, others say just because conservatives and libertarians put freedom in front of every cause doesn't mean they invented the word. So, again, just be mindful of that when you're looking at the coverage of politics, that the reporters who, even the ones who are trying to be on the up and up, sometimes can't help but buy into or basically have their own vocabulary co-opted by a right-wing media machine that has been working overtime on message framing rather than policy issues that would actually help people in Wisconsin and across the country. In our next hour, State Superintendent of Public Instruction Jill Underley will be here to discuss her recent State of Education address. You will recall on Friday, we reviewed Tim Michael's response to Underley's address, which more closely resembled a playground bully rather than someone who should be governor responsible for improving our kids' schools. So definitely looking forward to that conversation with her in the next hour. Brewers start their final homestand here with three series against St. Louis, Miami, and Arizona, and lost the last game of their final road trip to Cincinnati by a score of 2-1. So if the Brewers have any hopes of catching up in that final wild card spot and not being home for the entire postseason and beyond, they're going to have to pick up the pace a bit. Tomorrow, we have attorney Mark Thompson, member of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, and Up North News reporter Christina Lorre, and her recent interview with former White House photographer Pete Souza. And Luke, you had to remind me last week, when I think of Mark Thompson, I just think of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. I keep forgetting he has a radio show here because, unlike the rest of us narcissists, he doesn't name it after himself.
No, he leaves it out. Very similar to Dueling Tangents, though.
See, I knew you were going to go right there. You were going to point out that you didn't attach your name to your show either.
I was forced to add with Luke and Brian. We were told that we had to because Dueling Tangents doesn't make any sense otherwise. And so you got to at least throw your names on at the end. And I believe Mark Thompson is thrown at the end. I think it's the Paul Revere Show with Mark Thompson and kind of in the fine print. But yes, he does a radio show Monday nights. You're going to hear him tonight across the Civic Media Network from 7 to 8 p.m. So it's the Paul Revere Show. With Mark Thompson.
Nights from 7 to 8. Okay, I have to give that a go. I see you've gone with the what is it? Not the flannel season now, but the pullover zip sweaters.
Yeah, it was a little chilly when I left the house this morning. It was in the 40s even. I believe it was 48 or 49 when I left the house. So we got a pretty nasty windstorm that came through. The Columbus, Wisconsin, got quite a bit of the worst of the weather last night. I'm kind of just due south of there, and a small tree branch fell off the dead tree that I've yet to take care of, kind of reminding me, saying, hey, don't forget about this. So,
the winds howled up to 60 miles an hour in places. Cut their way just after 6 p.m. through Sheboygan and Washington counties into Jefferson County. Before that, when they went through here up north, brought a couple of minutes of hail, nearly marble size hail, and it came up rather fast. It had actually gone in between being sunny and cloudy, with it looked like maybe the threat of rain. So I thought, well, I've got time to get the lawn mowed. And at this time of year, with all the leaves falling, I try to do it in a way that I'm going in the same direction in any given area so that the chopped up leaves are being blown all the one way and hopefully eventually get to the property line and they're all in one place instead of scattered all over the yard. And about, midway, three quarters of the way through, I noticed the skies were getting really dark really quick. And so I tried to finish as quickly as I could. I don't know why. I don't know why I think about these things because, honest to goodness, 5 minutes later, the wind comes up. It's howling out of the north. My lawn is all full of chopped up leaves again. Why even bother? Just let it be. State Superintendent Dr. Jill Underley joins us right after this top of the hour break. You're up north.